Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
The hour is late. It's the night of the 2nd of June 1647 at the very grand Holdenby House in Northamptonshire. King Charles Stuart, King of England and Wales, Scotland and Ireland, and indeed a mess of little islands scattered around the place here and there, had already retired to bed, worn out by another hard, full day playing bowls at nearby Althorp House. He was slumbering in a suitably regal manner when he was woken by a commotion below. Angry, raised male voices. He recognised the commander of his guard, General Brown, but not the other voice, young, demanding, urgent, not to be denied. He reached out, he rang the little silver bell he always kept by his bed in case of emergency, or, well, just because he could, really. And his servant, James Maxwell, panicky, burst in. A young, round-haired officer was demanding access. Charles figured he was light on choices here, and so in came a roundhead ensign, with sword unsheathed and pistol in hand. Charles said calmly, "You may take away my life if you will, having your sword in your hand." Charles had long ago accepted that his destination might be martyrdom. Had that destination now arrived? Hello everyone and welcome to the History of England, episode 403, No Mere Mercenary Army. Last time we heard about how the defeat of the enemy without, in the form of the king, had freed Parliament to turn on the enemy within. The Presbyterians were now fully engaged on their attempt to eradicate their independent religious opponents by destroying the institution where they were strongest, the new model army. And they remained thoroughly confident of their ground. Of course, they were only doing what the country wanted and the country needed. They were removing a crushing financial weight from the bowed shoulders of their people. We have come to the moment of truth, then. Will the new model disband meekly? The Presbyterians in Parliament agree a soft deal with the king, restoring his place, imposing a national uniform church. Will the leaders of the new model, Fairfax and Cromwell, side with the legally constituted Parliament, for whose rights they took up arms, or stand by the comrades and brothers in arms with whom they have fought? Plus, of course, you'll be wanting to know about the young man with sword and pistol and what he has come to do. Well, the young man in question is Cornet George Joyce. And to explain his presence and his ends, let me take you to Drury Lane in Holborn in London just a few days before and to the home of one Oliver Cromwell. Now, Cromwell, just like Fairfax, was facing an agonising dilemma, trying to reconcile his loyalty to Parliament and his loyalty to the army. What he knew was that things were coming to a head. The Cromwell household in Drury Lane had become something of a centre for army officers based in London, probably including his son-in-law Henry Ireton and favourite army chaplain Hugh Peter. Usually they met in the house, while Elizabeth Cromwell served them small beer and bread and butter, no muffins on Drury Lane, of course, or at other times, they went out to Coleman Street to the Star Tavern. There they debated the king, the army, the commons. They argued back and forth about what they should do. News of their worries got back to John Lilburn in prison. He confided to a fellow inmate, Lewis Dive. He confided that Cromwell thought he could no longer keep his feet in both camps, Parliament or army. He must choose. Now, Lewis, it turns out, was a royalist, and he sent this news about the division in the parliamentary ranks straight back to the king. On the 31st of May, then, Cromwell had a new visitor in Drury Lane, the aforesaid George Joyce. George was a tailor's son from London, and by the age of 29 he had achieved the lowest rank for a commissioned officer in the cavalry, that of a cornet. Cornet Joyce was already effectively involved in a mutiny anyway. The members of the self-appointed Agitators Council of the Soldiers had arranged for him to raise a substantial troop of 500 horse and go and help another rebel regiment seizing the artillery train at Oxford before the Presbyterians could get their dirty little hands on it. There, he'd heard this rumour that Parliament meant to seize the king, agree a quick deal that would leave the army out in the cold. This would be a disaster. The agitators in the army had a plan to stop that dead in its tracks. But they needed the support of their generals. So, on that night of the 1st of June then, Joyce emerged from Drury Lane after his bread and butter, obviously, sent orders to his troops to go to Holdenby and set out at a gallop to meet them there. The following day, on the 2nd of June 1647, they clattered into the court at Holdenby. They faced Colonels Richard Graves and General Brown, who stood in their way with the King's Guard. It could have been bloody, but it was instead breezy, as it happens. The guardsmen greeted the troopers like long-lost buddies. Graves and Brown were utterly powerless. The plan Joyce had worked out with Cromwell had been implemented perfectly. They'd agreed that Joyce would take over the guard around the king, so that no one could then remove Charles from Holdenby without the agreement of the army. Phew, that was easy. Then everything changed. Joyce saw Colonel Richard Graves, the commander of one of the Parliament's regiments, riding hell for leather out of the estates. Now that was worrying. Where was he off in such a lather? Joyce realised he was on borrowed time, because Richard Graves was the super loyal commander Hollis had so nearly managed to replace Fairfax with earlier in the year. Pound to a penny said Graves would be back with a much bigger boat before you could say sovereignty of the people. Joyce dashed off a letter to Cromwell if he could be found, if not to Ireton or Fleetwood, asking for instructions, but actually he knew he was on his own. A reply would come way too late to help out. So Joyce and his men came to a decision. They must leave, and they must take the king with them. So, back to the king then in his jim-jams. Charles's time had not come. Joyce put away pistol and sword and politely explained that he meant no harm, but the king must leave with him in the morning. Charles figured this was the kind of choice with which Hobson would be familiar, and went along with it. But the next morning, 6 o'clock, bright and early, Charles's viewpoint had changed somewhat. The sinews had been stiffened. It occurred to him that he really ought to check the paperwork. So he asked what commission, what orders Joyce had to remove him. Young Joyce replied earnestly that he was trying to avoid a second civil war and needless bloodshed. Just sort of hyperbole you'd expect from a young'un. Charles had something more specific in mind, and he asked again. Joyce, in desperation, told him he'd already answered that. Please shush now. Charles thought that wasn't good enough and kept going. I pray you, Mr. Joyce, deal ingenuously with me, and tell me what commission you have. Here is my commission. Where? Behind me, said Joyce. Behind Joyce stood 500 fully armed troopers. Maybe some were thoughtfully feeling the edge of their sword, or checking the sights of their carbines, who knows. It is as fair a commission, and as well written as I have seen a commission written in my life. A company of handsome, proper gentlemen, as I have seen in a great while. The conversation went on. Charles asked where they were going, and Joyce appears not to have thought about that. He suggested Oxford. Charles didn't like that, so they went through a few places and hit on Loughborough. Well, they didn't, actually. Charles suggested Newmarket, because he'd gone hunting there with his dad back in the day. All right. Joyce said, OK, then. It was to be a spookily helpful decision, as it happens. But anyway, off they set. Now there's more, but isn't that a delightful story? There are so many things I like about that. The young 29-year-old Joyce, clearly full of enthusiasm and radicalised fervour, but in a situation way above his pay grade. And then where should we go? Ooh, I don't know. Loughborough, that's nice at this time of year. Conversation is a joy. And then they go to Newmarket because Charles liked the hunting. I mean, really? Come on, folks, this is supposed to be a revolution for crying out loud. This won't look good on the back cover blurb. It is also very difficult to dislike a man who can make such an excellently dry gag with the "it is an excellent commission" line. Cool, suave, funny, dry as a bone. Generally, it's thought Joyce was indicating force when he pointed at his trooper. The more revolutionary in spirit have suggested that Joyce was pointing to his men as representatives of the people's will. I love the second, but I'm going for the first, to be honest. As to the business end of all of this, Joyce always said the whole thing was Cromwell's idea. When Cromwell firmly denied any such thing and accused Joyce of being economical with the truth, Charles acidly told Oliver, "I'll not believe you unless you hang him." Most historians square the circle as I have done, that Cromwell agreed that Joyce should take control of the king at Haldenby, but not abduct him and remove him from there. Anyway, the long and short of that is that Cromwell had made his choice, army or parliament. Convinced as he was that parliament was the rightful source of authority, he would nonetheless not see his colleagues in arms thrown to the lions. As he would have known, Fairfax had also chosen the army. Thomas Fairfax had ordered a general muster of the whole army, which was to be near the army HQ at Bury St Edmunds, conveniently just outside, you guessed it, Newmarket. That night, as the soldiers began to assemble at Newmarket, Hollis and Co., probably unaware of the king's abduction at this point, decided to put the pressure on and arrest Cromwell. But someone warned him, probably God's request as far as Oliver was concerned, but God's tool was also the leveller William Wallin, who later claimed he persuaded Cromwell to leave. But however it happened, Cromwell left Drury Lane along with Hugh Peter and the Muffin Man, of course, and set off for Newmarket at the crack of dawn. Hollis had missed his man. That night, the Commons met in continuous session, in something of a panic, it must be said. They'd now heard of the king's abduction. They were also getting bad news from the London militia, who were not taking to their new Presbyterian officers at all well. None of the sort of bonding you'd like to see was happening. So at 2 o'clock in the morning, they rather caved. They finally decided that maybe they'd been a little hasty, and they struck the declaration of dislike from the parliamentary record. 3 days later, on the 7th of June, a full indemnity ordinance for all soldiers was passed. They sent commissioners out on the road to tell the army of their general loveliness and that all was once more sweetness and life and so sorry didn't mean it. Would it be enough? In Newmarket, the army were having a bit of a love-in on the 4th of June 1647. Well, I say love-in. Before the love-in could start, the Presbyterian officers who had chosen to accept Hollis and Co.'s command to go to Ireland took the occasion to leave the new model. It appears there are about 57 of them, which isn't a massive number, but it is significant, because the officers that replaced them were mainly promoted from the ranks. That meant the remaining officers of the new model were of even more humble origins, yet more radical, yet more homogeneous in their independent religious views. Anyway, the leaving Presbyterian officers were apparently hooted off the field, and then the love-in could begin. The agitators of the soldiers had put together a petition, the humble representation of the dissatisfactions of the army. It was signed by their officers on behalf of the men. Fairfax did not say, "Get back in line, you horrible little men." Instead, he accepted it. He then went and visited every single one of the 13 regiments and had said representation read out to each and every one. His message was of conciliation, a message of support for the army, but urging them to be moderate in their demands and to respect the civil authority of Parliament. His charm, charisma, integrity won their hearts as always. He was cheered everywhere he went. And that night Cromwell arrived and joined the party. It is at this point that Henry Ireton really begins to take centre stage in the English Revolution. He is one of those who does not have anything like the recognition he should have. He is, it's got to be said, a rather difficult man to like. Severely religious, iron-willed, relentless, not many laughs on him. Clarendon and the Royalists hated him, largely because he was effective and forensic. The Levellers would grow to hate him too, because he was one of the army grandees with whom they'd fall out later, and he was less radical than they were, as he'll show at the Putney debates. But he was still deeply radical for the time and a genuine revolutionary. He was rigorous, iron-willed, selfless. He lacked any Cromwellian grandstanding, though he and Cromwell were always very close, and not just because of the family ties. His fellow officers and independents loved him. John Cook, the man who will prosecute the king, wrote of his dedication and hard work, "Seldom thinking it time to eat till he had done the work of the day at 9 or 10 at night, and then will sit up as long as any man had business with him." He was realistic as well as radical, and it is he who will be the architect and penmaster for the stream of petitions and agreements that come from the army over the next couple of years, and his rigour created coherence from the mass of opinions, demands and petitions that came from so many different parties. Ian Gentles, the historian, is very impressed. To Ireton, as much as any individual, belongs the credit for calling monarchy to account and erecting the English Republic on its ruins. This is the first time, then, when Ireton produces an army document. He seems to have got together with all the agitators, talked through their desires, their grievances, petitions, other matters, and then pulled it all together into a conclusion called the Solemn Engagement of the Army. Three big things to mention about the Solemn Engagement. Firstly, it was more than just a manifesto of grievances. It was a sacred covenant, a bond, an oath in the sight of God and their comrades, a commitment presented and assented to publicly by every regiment and every soldier. The army assembled engaged that we shall not willingly disband nor divide until their grievances were satisfied. Secondly, it declared that no one in England should be subject to oppression from those who had abused Parliament. That, my friends, is coded language for Hollis and Co. Coded language for them to be fired. It's personal now. Either they go or we go. And thirdly, is probably the most remarkable of all from the Solemn Engagement. The engagement set up a new body to manage the new model army, a General Council of the Army. The council would be composed of the senior officers, obviously, who currently formed the Council of War, but now there would be a General Council too, to which each regiment would send two officers and two soldiers for each regiment, called agitators. But again, for agitators, think rather of the idea of an agent. It is at once a stroke of genius, appropriating the informal system that had arisen among the soldiers, and also extraordinarily democratic. Every soldier would now have a voice in the running of the army. Is that any way to run an army, I wonder? Surely, officers of the time normally would have given the lippy a bit of a thrashing and told them to do what they were told. Okay, so the Solemn Engagement was taken by all. The army were then presented on the 10th of June with the commissioners from Parliament, and Fairfax courteously drew the army up for them to listen to what they had to say. It didn't go well. The commissioners left with shouts of "Justice! Justice!" ringing in their ears, words, thought Hollis bitterly later when he was writing his memoirs, that Cromwell and Ireton had taught them. I don't think they needed any teaching at all, as it happens. Fairfax wrote to Parliament to say that the army sought no alteration of civil government. But this is the last time Fairfax will keep trying to keep the new model away from politics. I have no doubt Fairfax and Cromwell heartily did not want this kind of confrontation, but there really was no choice. Getting the army justice had become political, and no one trusted the Commons, who had tried to destroy the new model army anymore, and showed them so little respect and gratitude for their sacrifice, the army were insulted. And there were ideas circulating now about what they had been fighting for all this time, ideas and thoughts that could no longer be rebottled. These ideas came partly from the soldiers and partly from the likes of Ireton, but partly because leveller influence was beginning to grow. Men such as Wallin, Lilburn, Sexby, Wildman, William Allen, Richard Overton were either part of the army or their writings were becoming well known and distributed there. The big change came on the 14th of June when Fairfax and the Council of War issued a document called the Declaration from Sir Thomas Fairfax and the Army, once more Ireton's work. It started with a proud statement of who they were. We are not a mere mercenary army, hired to serve any arbitrary power of state, but called forth and conjured by the several declarations of Parliament to the defence of our own and the people's just rights and liberties. This idea, this sense of being drawn from and representatives of the people was now core to the new model army's identity and what made it a revolutionary force. So this declaration now included politics, a demand for regular parliaments based on fairer constituencies, and it called for the impeachment of 11 members of parliament, Hollis and Co., essentially. And the army was now on the march towards London, super slowly. On the 21st of June, it then issued the Remonstrance of the Representatives of the Army, and together with the 14th of June declaration, we're now getting to a full political programme. There should be regular parliaments based on coherent constituencies. There should also be reform of the justice system and the judiciary. There should be absolute liberty of conscience. And at last, that sense of looking at the whole story, of a willingness to get the nation heal, recognition that the king must be part of the settlement, and much gentler language about royalists and their life in the new world. Even angry, honest John Lilburn approved of all this, thanking his old mate Cromwell for the active pains he was taking in the path of reform. And in London, levellers remained active, and indeed from March, Richard Overton in particular launched a pamphleting campaign. This was not easy on him, nor his family. The leveller movement very much involved women as radical as the men. Mary Overton, Richard's wife, kept the presses running and was producing copies of Richard's latest appeal, Regal Tyranny Discovered, stitching pamphlets together. When soldiers arrived, pushed their way into the house to destroy the press and confiscate the leaflets, Mary was hauled off to the Lords. There, the Speaker of the House of Lords demanded to know the names from her of those who had brought copies of the pamphlet. Mary refused to give her single name. She was ordered to prison. Pregnant, clutching her six-month-old baby, she was dragged on hurdles through jeering crowds along the muddy streets of London to the House of Correction at Bridewell. There, she was incarcerated. Eventually, she would be freed, but not before she'd miscarried. She was furious about her treatment and wrote that the common people of England were enslaved by a lordly, arbitrary vassalage and bondage with that Norman brood of insolent, dominating tyrants and usurpers, the House of Lords. Elizabeth Lilburn was also imprisoned, as was Richard Overton, but he continued to write from prison, with many ideas that would appear later in the Leveller programme, criminal reform, educational provision, the concept of natural right, rights with higher authority than even Parliament. Meanwhile, he, Wallin, Lilburn all maintained their contacts in the army, like Sexby, Wildman and William Allen. The Levellers were becoming more organised. It was becoming a network, in touch with each other, planning and working together, like a model of the modern political activist. The storm was coming.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
OK, what of Presbyterian London then? Well, resolve in Parliament was weakening. Several provincial MPs began to withdraw their shares from Hollis & Co., as did Bulstrode Whitlock. Now look, our Bulstrode will be a master trimmer. By the by, none better. So if you saw Bulstrode sidling away, it was a good time to check the cut of your political jib because there's stormy weather ahead. Despite the sliding backwards, though, despite their earlier concessions at heart, Hollis and the members of the Derby House Committee remained committed to the counter-revolution, desperate to make it work. Edward Massey, the ex-Western Association commander, rode through the streets of London in his coach, inciting the citizens to defend their city against the new model army. Double guards were posted on the city walls, the portcullises of the gates clanged shut. The mayor called the trained bands to arms. The militiamen tried to turn their enthusiasm up to 11. Most, it has to be said, managed no more than one or two, sadly for the mayor. But he tried. On the 15th of June, Hollis defiantly persuaded Parliament to pass a resolution aimed squarely at the forehead of the army, demanding the king be brought to London immediately. They also decided to define where the English Rubicon lay, over which the army could not cross, and it was to lie in an arc 30 miles outside London. Over that virtual brook, the new model and Fairfax must not cross. Fairfax, therefore, moved St Albans, 25 miles away. So that went well then. Fairfax also kept up a correspondence with the London Council and William Lenthall, Speaker of the Commons. People tend to think about Fairfax as being non-political, but that's not really true. What he probably was not ambitious for power. But anyway, at the start of July, an important blow was struck by all this correspondence. He asked the Speaker to be placed under command of all the forces in England, and to support his argument, noted that order must be re-established in the Northern Army, which had rebelled against its Presbyterian commander, Poyntz. This is rather a delicious irony, because the rebellion had been caused by new model agitators. But it made a good argument. Parliament saw that they had lost this card, went for conciliation, and agreed to appoint Fairfax as the general of all military forces. Concession was met with concession. Fairfax drew the army outside the Rubicon back to Reading. And at Reading then, under the spirit of this kind of rather forced conciliation, he then called this General Council of the Army, which had been promised. It was to meet on the 16th of July. Now look, it's the Putney debates that gets all the press, although quite a lot of you, I'm sure, have never heard of that. But anyway, it does. But don't worry, we'll be coming back to the Putney debates in episode 405. But the Reading General Council is almost as remarkable. It started with a debate with the agitators, who demanded an immediate march on London. Cromwell and Ireton talked them down. Cromwell's view was that achieving consensus in healing was critical to the future. And this is what he said. Whatever we get by treaty will be firm and durable. We shall avoid the great objection that we got things of Parliament by force. But he agreed that they should demand the restoration of the old officers of the London trained bands and that the imprisoned levellers Lilburn and Overton should be freed. Then, on the second day, Ireton produced his Magnus Opus, the document that was to become known as the Heads of Proposals. The Heads of Proposals seems to have mainly been Ireton's work, but it was also produced in consultation with key independents in Parliament. In particular, the kind of triumvirate we keep talking about, Say and Seal in the Lords, Harry Vane and Oliver St John from the Commons, the old independent muckers. He also seems to have corresponded with a royalist envoy from the Queen, actually, one John Barclay. And so these are the proposals then that Ireton, after this consultation, put to the General Council to form the basis of an offer to the King designed to wrest control back from the Presbyterians. Unlike the Newcastle propositions, which had been broadly about power, the Heads of Proposals was an attempt to achieve genuine reform and a better world. More than that, it was an attempt to heal old enmities and create a settlement acceptable to all of them. The spirit of reconciliation, at last, seemed to have ridden back into town. Under the heads, Parliament would be elected every 2 years, rotten boroughs should be closed and a new rational constituency map constructed on the basis of the taxation yield of each county and borough. Parliament would control the militia, but for only 10 years. After that, it would be returned to the King. Parliament would appoint ministers of state for 10 years also, but once again, after trust had been re-established, a permanent system would be implemented whereby Parliament would propose three names for which the King would choose his minister. So government would be a partnership. A council of state would now replace the old Privy Council, with members holding office for a fixed term so as to reduce corruption and favouritism. Royalists would be banned from public office and Parliament, so there's an element of retribution there, but unlike earlier and indeed later proposals, that exclusion would last for only 5 years, and then that was it. No more retribution, an act of oblivion. In addition, the system of compounding would be reformed to radically reduce the penalties on royalists. And, critically, only 5 individuals were to be exempted from this general act of oblivion. That's a very important factor for a king tortured by the memory of Strafford. Finally, religion. The Book of Common Prayer was to be permitted, unlike under the Newcastle Propositions. Bishops were allowed to return and continue, unlike the Newcastle Propositions. But, critically, bishops would be shorn of their coercive power. They would be spiritual leaders only, not tools of royal oppression. There would be no penalties for not going to church for anyone. So that's it, the guts of the heads of proposals. It was the most open statement of toleration to appear for another 40 years. It was an impressive document. It was almost equally extraordinary that the senior commanders of the army, rather than just doing it, given their authority and the discussions they'd had with Parliament, laid it before the soldiers of the General Council for discussion and agreement before they took it to King or confirmed with Parliament. Over 100 soldiers, therefore, listened to Ireton talk about the plan. One of the agitators, a noted leveller, responded on all of their behalf. "These are things of great weight, having relation to the settling of a kingdom, which is great work, truly the work we all expect to have a share in." He asked for time for them all to consider it, and they went off in a huddle. The following day they returned to council, gave their agreement that the heads of proposals was acceptable to all. The heads were then sent to Parliament on the 20th of July, and Say and Seal and the Lords took it up immediately. Though, it has to be said, there are only 12 Lords left in the House of Lords at this point. So, it seemed at this point that the approach of the army had won. The Commons accepted this was the way forward. Hollis and the 11 members retired from the House. Control of the London trained bands was returned once more to Fairfax. Great, unity restored, bish, bash, and indeed, bosh. All that needed to happen now was for Charles to seize this generous and innovative way forward, and at last we can all get back to being a nation again. That then must take us back to Charlie Ladd. What had things been like for the dear fellow since the comfort of Holdenby had been left behind? How was he taking to army camps? Well, I could not be more pleased to inform you that Charles had been charmed and delighted by the reception he had received at the hands of the army. There was scarcely a trace of republicanism at this point in the new model army, and Cromwell and Fairfax themselves were full of warmth and admiration. They welcomed their king with open arms. They offered him every honour. Unlike at Newcastle and Holdenby, he was allowed to use the Book of Common Prayer. He was allowed to have access to his favourite Anglican chaplains. We know a lot of this through the memoirs of one John Barclay, the Queen's personal envoy. Henrietta Maria had been in contact with her hub constantly, of course, and urged him to just make the damned deal. Who cares what flavour of Protestant churns you all have? You're all damned heretics anyway. Just say yes. I paraphrase and horribly simplify. Obviously, I apologise to Henrietta Maria. Actually, her real sticking point was over control of the army. But on religion, just do the deal, King. Anyway, Barclay had been sent over by Henrietta Maria to oil the wheels. He was welcomed into camp as well, and had friendly chats with Fairfax and with Cromwell. And in fact, it seems a bit of a love-in was going on. Cromwell, in particular, was moved to tears at the sight of Charles with his children. The French ambassador recalls Cromwell's bemusement that a simple, gentleman farmer like himself was hobnobbing with the king, not something your Huntingdon gentry farmer would have expected. So, trying to sniff out some stuff for his monthly report, Monsieur l'Ambassadeur Bellièvre asked Cromers what his aims were. Oliver looked a bit vague until he muttered, "None rises so high as he who knows not whither he is going." It is an interesting statement. I have heard more than one person expand this to include a philosophy of the whole Civil War. Because again, unlike the American and French revolutions, there had been no John Locke, no Montesquieu, no Enlightenment. There was no roadmap to follow or model to reach for. No one had expected the rebellion to become a revolution. No one journeys so far as those who do not know where they're going. Anyway, so, none rises so high as he who knows not whither he is going. As regards Cromwell, of course, royalists would later spin this as ambition. Cromwell had no ambition or limits that he would set himself. There's no height to which he could not rise. On the other end of the spectrum, it is part of a story of Cromwell, the honest, unambitious man who never really wanted power. It was just thrust upon him by circumstance. That he is here simply expressing his astonishment at how far fate had brought him. But maybe it's even more simple. Jim, of this parish, suggested that Cromwell was talking to the ambassador of an international, not necessarily friendly power, and he was just being vague because he had no intention whatsoever of spilling any beans. Actually, Jim, that is now my favourite explanation. Other conversations tend to suggest, at this stage anyway, it is not personal ambition that had brought Fairfax and Cromwell to this point. So later then, for example, before presenting Charles with the best proposition he will ever have, Cromwell said to him that they thought no men could enjoy their lives and estates quietly without the king had his rights. And he described the king that he'd fought tooth and nail against for the last 5 years as the uprightest and most conscientious man of these three kingdoms. Golly. This seems to suggest that at this stage at least, both Fairfax and Cromwell just wanted to finish this and all go home. So, all seems set fair for peace. And yet Berkeley found his king suspicious. He found him disbelieving yet again of the motives of these rebels. It was now that Charles confided to a rather shocked Berkeley they did not trust these commanders because none of them had asked him for personal honours or favours or personal rewards. Apparently, that is what required on the part of serious political operators and courtiers. Without such motives, they surely couldn't be serious about their proposal. What's in it for them? By now, Charles was physically being moved progressively down towards Hampton Court, and he had arrived at the grand house of Woburn Abbey. And it was here that copies of the heads of the proposals appeared with his morning post. Berkeley was super excited about these proposals. He saw in them the real opportunity for peace and a new future at last, and he told Charles so. To his despair and astonishment, Charles did not seem happy at all. At a minimum, he wanted the Church of England confirmed in its power and its law, with its bishops as they had been, and also none of his friends to be exempted from pardon at all. And he was confident, chipper almost, firm in his recalcitrance, because he knew, or he thought he knew, that they could get nowhere without him, without their king's agreements. He held all the cards. I shall see them glad ere long to accept for equal terms. At this moment, unfortunately, Jack Ashburnham appeared again, our sort of Tim Nice but Dim courtier, and he appeared to have as much backbone as a jellyfish, so he did nothing but agree with Charles. Also, Charles's other counsellors appear and fill his head with dreams. John Maitland, Lord Lauderdale, was there with seemingly great plans for royalist revival in Scotland. Letters were around from Presbyterians in London, promising their bowels were feeling firm, they had plans for the greatest comeback since Lazarus. Berkeley was aghast at all this. He kept banging away that here was the most generous offer Charles was ever likely to get. In a very famous conversation, he pleaded with Charles that with these proposals, never was a crown so near lost, so cheaply recovered as His Majesty's would be if they agreed upon such terms. Well, while Charles was mulling, London erupted. The news got out that the Presbyterians had surrendered to the Independents and that the 11 members had fled Parliament. Presbyterian ministers thunder resistance from their pulpits. Angry militiamen, watermen, reformados gathered in Skinner's Hall and raged against this capitulation. And they swore their own great engagement a mirror image of the army's engagement. Thousands of reformados protested in St James' Field. The London Common Council accepted their petitions. Hollis and the 11 members came out from hiding and whipped up the passions, presenting a petition to Parliament to bring the King back to London immediately in defiance of the army. But still, Parliament, for the moment, stood firm and rejected their petition. But that simply enraged the reformados still more. Now there was a riot. A mob swirled and crashed into Parliament, stormed into the chamber of the House of Lords itself, bullied the Lords to pass acts restoring the militia to city control. And there was stuff being thrown around to encourage them, ladies and gentlemen, and I must use the word excrement on a public podcast because, gentle listeners, such was included in the throwing. MPs and Lords asked for help from the mayor to restore order from all this. And the mayor said, busy actually, so sorry, let me get back to you on that. In the end, 8 peers and 57 MPs fled the riots in the city and found their way to the army camp at Reading. Back in London, their flight once more readjusted the balance of power in Commons, now back in favour of Hollis and Co and the Presbyterians, and for a week, the 11 members returned and tried to revive the counter-revolution. But despite those riots, it had become increasingly clear that support within London and its suburbs was in fact as thin as an after-dinner mint. Outside of London, there was nothing but tumbleweed for their cause, not a leaf nor a twig stirred in support. The Levellers and their allies in the army watching all of this in London were furiously demanding a march now on London immediately by the army to dissolve Parliament, force new free elections. Let's stop pussyfooting around here. But Fairfax and Cromwell knew lasting peace lay in negotiation and accommodation with the King. So back at Woburn, Charles had sent to Fairfax that he was prepared to discuss the heads of proposals. And so it was with hope and optimism that on the 28th of July 1647, Fairfax's delegation of four appeared at Woburn. The group was led by Henry Ireton, and along with him were Colonels Thomas Rainsborough, Robert Hammond, and Rich. They were ushered in to see the King with great hopes. Ireton must have been optimistic that here peace was in his grasp. If they could clinch this now, here was the ultimate opportunity to finally heal the rift in the nation. Furthermore, if Charles accepted it now or anything close, Fairfax then had plans. He would take the army, he would have them march to London with Charles at its head. Surely then the last of the resistance must melt away. A new country would dawn which would set a new standard. A constitutional monarch, reformed and refreshed Parliament, elected on fairer terms, a level of religious liberty unequalled anywhere in Europe except maybe the Netherlands. It was a thrilling prospect. I can feel the excitement as I write. So, back to the meeting then. As Charles faced these four men, not a drop of blue blood amongst them, he spoke the language not of reconciliation, but the language of division, the language of contempt. Or in the words of Berkeley himself, entertained them with very tart and bitter discourses. He insisted on an established church. He brought up Strafford again. The meeting went on for hours. For 3 hours, repeatedly Charles made the same point, displaying again and again the bottomless sea of his overconfidence. He insisted that in the end everyone must bend to his will, because no agreement was possible without the King. He looked them in the eye and told them so straight. You cannot be without me. You will fall to ruin if I do not sustain you. All this talk was so much blarney in his view. In the end, you know you'll have to come back cap in hand. No one could quite believe what they were hearing. At one stage, Berkeley could bear it no longer. He leant over and he whispered in the King's ear, Sir, your Majesty speaks as if you had some secret strength and power that I do not know of. And since your Majesty hath concealed it from me, I wish you had concealed it from these men too. Charles had his personal certainty from God. He also had Lauderdale's promises that the Scots were fixing to bring an army south. There was all that chaos in London, and anyway, Charles didn't want to heal. He wanted to win. He wanted his party triumphant and the rebels put in their place. Nothing less would satisfy his sense of honour. And so neither Barclay nor Ireton could shift him, though they kept trying. Colonel Thomas Rainsborough, on the other hand, had far less regard and patience with all this, so while the debate was still going on, he got up and left. I always think not enough is made of this. I mean, one does not simply leave the presence of the king in the 17th century any more than one simply walks into Mordor. Rainsborough was a man of action. He held radical views which would lead him increasingly towards the levellers. It feels here like he'd just crossed a mental line. He'd done with this. The king was incorrigible, had no spirit of compromise, and he must be forced, not conciliated. In the end, the rest gave up as well, and the best chance for peace and healing died at Woburn Abbey in July 1647. The army as a whole were, of course, well aware that this was all going on through their agitators, and the king's contempt outraged many of them. Feelings towards the king, as I say, had been remarkably positive in the army towards this man they'd been fighting, but that now began to change as well. So, what to do then? Chaos in London, an uncooperative king? Time for Fairfax and the army to take matters in hand. And we will talk about those matters, and indeed those hands, in the next episode. Until then, everyone, I hope you do not grieve too much that this great opportunity for peace, truth, and light and justice has been so callously thrown aside. I would like to thank you all for your patience and interest, and do let me know what you think at thehistoryofengland.co.uk or at Facebook or email me, or indeed pin ballads and libels to the door on your local in the 17th century idiom. Until then, thank you very much for listening, everyone. Good luck and have a great week.
Deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market. Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.